KABF and Speak Up Arkansas would like to thank our underwriters, Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, the Arkansas Education Association, Arkansas Children's, and the Arkansas Coalition for Peace and Justice, all supporting KABF, the voice of the people.
You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I'm Rebecca Zimmerman. For the past year, a group of state legislators has been meeting to create recommendations on how to change Arkansas's tax system. They've just released the recommendations, and they could have a big impact on the state. Today, we will discuss the Tax Reform and Relief Legislative Task Force's recommendations and how they will affect everyday Arkansans. Later in the show, we'll talk about Issue 5, the minimum wage amendment that will be on the ballot this November. But first, for the discussion around the tax task force's recommendations, we have three guests today: Glenn Hooks with Arkansas Sierra Club, Bo Ryle with Arkansas Hospital Association, and Rich Huddleston with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Thank you all so much for being here today. Glenn, do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Sure. Hi, I'm Glenn Hooks. I'm the director of the Arkansas Sierra Club, which is a branch of the nation's oldest and largest environmental protection organization. We work on clean air and clean water issues, healthy forest issues, and a lot of clean energy issues, trying to get rid of dirty power plants and replace them with solar and wind energy. So I'm glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Rebecca.
I'm Bo Ryle, President and CEO of the Arkansas Hospital Association. All the hospitals in Arkansas are members of our association, and we advocate on their behalf.
And I'm Rich Huddleston, Executive Director of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, and I'm a 41-year-old nonprofit child advocacy group, and our mission is to ensure that every child has the resources and opportunities they need to lead healthy and productive lives. And so we work on just about every issue impacting children and families, from health care to juvenile justice to taxes to the child welfare system. So we're pretty much all over the board when it comes to those issues. So.
Okay, well, I want to get started with a tongue twister. What is the Tax Reform and Relief Legislative Task Force, and what were the recommendations they just released?
Sure, I'll take the first stab at that. And so the task force was created by legislation passed during the 2017 state legislative session. And they were charged with coming up with recommendations to cut taxes, basically, but also to do some tax reform. And they were supposed to come up with a final report actually this week. I mean, so they put out the first draft of their report. And I'm happy to talk about the details of some of that if you want, Rebecca. But so it contains a number of big pieces to it, but I think kind of the bottom line to their recommendations is that depending on which plan the legislature ends up enacting around personal income tax cuts, the overall plan could reduce state revenue anywhere from $275 million to $350 million annually. And it includes some personal income tax cuts, with kind of the big provision there being to reduce the top rate for upper income taxpayers from 6.9% to 5.9%. That provision alone is going to cost roughly in the neighborhood of $191 million. But it also contains some corporate income tax cuts as well, which are kind of technical in their nature. But those corporate income tax cuts, which would benefit mostly larger corporations, also would have a major impact on the state budget. The plan that they've released doesn't do much in the way of raising revenues. I mean, there are some small sales tax changes in terms of removing some exemptions, but I think the big revenue raiser, which quite frankly we don't know how much it's actually going to raise, would be to require out-of-state online sellers, like over the internet, that don't have a physical presence in Arkansas, to collect from Arkansas consumers that buy their goods over the internet any sales taxes that are due to the state of Arkansas. And so that change could have a big impact. We just don't know how much that's going to be at the present time. But mostly the plan that they put forward, I mean, really is about tax cuts, and it's about tax cuts for upper income individuals, and it's about tax cuts for corporations.
And if you have any questions for our show, you can give us a call at 501-433-0088. And so these recommendations, are they set in stone, or they still have to be decided on?
No, they're subject to change. I will say the big option to cut personal income taxes is being favored by the governor. And so I think that's the income tax option that the legislature is likely to seriously consider in 2019. But I think you're also going to see strong support in this legislature for the corporate income tax cuts. I think what's probably a little problematic, quite frankly, is whether or not the legislature will go along for the few revenue raisers in the package. And so we talked about the collection of online sales taxes that are due on online purchases by Arkansas consumers. There's also a couple provisions in there that could help raise tax revenue for highways and roads. And there's also a proposal in there to get rid of the capital gains exemption for capital gains over $10 million, which is basically investments. So it's unknown whether or not they'll go along with those small revenue raisers, which quite frankly are not that big. But anytime you talk about a tax increase at the legislature, it's going to run into some opposition.
And so the General Assembly still has to vote on this.
Yes,
in 2019.
Yeah, next year in the session, they still have to be passed by the legislature. And of course, we're hoping that they will consider the impacts on the state budget. I know our other two guests are going to talk about that.
Well, yeah, and I, now that we've gotten to those somewhat confusing details of all the corporate loopholes and things they were discussing, what impact would that have on the state budget? I mean, we talk about tax cuts and people have different ideas of what that means. But practically, from your point of view, what does that mean for the state budget and for programs?
Well, Rich gave a great summary there of the long list of tax reform measures out there. I guess the question would be, is that a wish list? Is that a long-term plan? The state obviously cannot afford $300 million in one fiscal year. So it depends upon that number, the impact on the budget. There seems to be legislative consensus at this point about reducing the state income tax rate in some way. So that could be a concern about how big that rate cut will be. But when you're talking about the state budget and the impact, you're talking about general education, public education, which they're going to get their funds because it's Supreme Court mandated, so they're going to get funded. But then it brings, if you will, a food fight amongst the others of higher education, health and human services, corrections. And then, as we've seen the last couple of years, the highway department looking for highway funds out of general revenue in addition to the gasoline taxes that are out there. So it brings a big fight in the legislature, and choices, makes hard choices for legislators on what to fund and what not to fund.
I think that's right. And, you know, we're taking a step back and we're thinking about tax policy. Some people get involved in politics and activism because they have a cause that they hold dear, something they really believe in. And other people kind of like the tax and the wonkier side of things. And you see that with our candidates, too. I think you see candidates, a lot of candidates, feel like they're never going to lose a vote by saying, I'm going to go cut your taxes. But the reality is, when you go cut their taxes, you're cutting programs that benefit people in the state of Arkansas. Every dollar that's spent has some constituency out there, so it gets to be a little bit more difficult. I like to think of tax plans and budgets really as moral documents. You know, you think about who are we going to fund and who are we going to cut. What you're making choices here. And both Rich and Bo kind of alluded to roads, you know, for instance. If we're going to cut these, make massive tax cuts in Arkansas, one of the things that we have to think about is how are we going to make up some of that revenue for things that we need. I've already seen, and these guys I'm sure have already seen too, that there are some proposals out there to raise fees on, say, electric vehicles or on hybrid cars, you know, because you get a lot of the road money from the gas tax. And so if you have an electric car, you're not buying gas. If you have a hybrid, you're buying less gas. And so you're setting up a moral question there, in my opinion, as an environmentalist. Are you going to punish somebody by increasing their fees that they have to pay for buying an electric vehicle, being fuel efficient, and not polluting our air? I think that's a bad choice. That's not a good public policy choice. There's going to be any number of public policy choices like that that we're going to have to face in this upcoming General Assembly. But that's just one right there that could be popular in this legislature as a way of raising money on the backs of people that they think are not contributing their fair share. I would argue that they're actually helping by keeping the air quality good.
And to your point, it reminds me of something that our old senior policy analyst would always say, that no matter what your first issue is, your second issue always needs to be tax and budget issues.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So speaking of taxes in terms of the state budget and bringing in revenue, how much does our state budget rely on tax revenue? What are some other sources of revenue? And again, how much is that of it overall budget is made up of tax revenue?
Well, I mean, it's really the bulk of the state budget. I mean, you know, we also get a fair amount of funding from the federal government for various things. For health care and for for food assistance programs, for other things. There's a smaller share that's generated by user fees and things like that. But, you know, but pretty much every state legislative session, the battle really is over state general revenue. And state general revenue really does come from tax revenue. And so anytime we're talking about the legislature, possibly adopting a tax plan that looks something like what the tax force put out, you're talking about major financial impacts for many of the programs that Bo talked about.
And again, if you have a question for our guests, you can give us a call at 501-433-0088. And so this isn't the first round of proposed tax cuts. I believe there's been three rounds of tax cuts that have already passed in the General Assembly.
Yeah, well, if you look at 2013, 2015, 2017, the tax cuts that they passed during those three sessions, came close to about $300 million. Now, some of the changes that they passed during those three sessions will be undone or superseded by some of the changes that are being proposed in this plan. So it won't be a case where you've had the $300 million in tax cuts during those three sessions, and then you'll have another $300 million on top of that. But even if that's the case, you're still talking about a lot of money. You're still talking probably between those three sessions and what's likely to happen this session, you're probably still overall talking, quite frankly, about over $500 million, that's being taken out of the state budget during those three sessions and during the upcoming session, you start talking $500 million out of the state budget. That's real money. So, you know.
It's especially real money in a state like Arkansas. You know, I'm an Arkansas native. I've lived here my whole life. This is where we are. Just bluntly, we're one of the poorer states in the country. We rely, a lot of our citizens rely on government help. And that's not a matter of political ideology or the way that an individual particularly votes. It's about facts. You know, we have a lot of needs here. And so when we, a small state that doesn't have a lot of money, are looking to cut this much out of our budget, we're looking at real pain here. And I think that when we're looking at this moral document, as I mentioned a while ago, are we comfortable with cutting $500 million or several hundred million dollars in taxes to actually, in this particular case, lower the top tax rate? We're making choices. We're going to be making choices about, are we going to, how much are we going to cut from our schools? How much are we going to cut from programs that feed kids? How much are we going to cut from, say, people who run our state parks and inspect our air and our water quality? You know, these are real choices here, and it's not like we're a gigantic state where $500 million is not going to be felt. That's real pain.
And that brings me to my next question. What impact have y'all already seen in your different issue areas, the environment, healthcare, education, and other issues from the previous tax cuts? What tough decisions have already been made because of this?
Well, I think the downward pressure, once these tax cuts are implemented, there's a pressure on the state agencies to find reductions. And of course, I represent hospitals, so we're particularly concerned about the Medicaid budget. And there was a legislative healthcare task force formed a couple of years ago, and they identified over $800 million in savings in the Medicaid program as a goal. So they've been trying to achieve that goal, the Medicaid division, over the last couple of years. So what we've seen is a reduction in the eligibility of those on Medicaid, particularly the Arkansas Works program. There's been an aggressive push to limit eligibility, as in sending out letters to those recipients. If they don't respond in 10 days, then their benefits are cut. If they don't respond to any kind of correspondence, they lose their eligibility. And then with the Arkansas Works program, there's a work requirement. And today is the day that the work requirement is going into, it's been in effect for 3 months. But if anybody does not report, or doesn't have an exemption, or doesn't report their work requirements on an online portal, then they're going to lose their benefits. So today is a day where they have to make those, if they haven't, if 5,426 people are on the line today, if they haven't made their online portal that they've been working notification, then they're going to lose their coverage this month. So we're particularly concerned about the people who've been losing coverage because of that downward pressure of the state budget. Where are we going to find savings? So they're looking at Medicaid for savings.
So you think the new work requirements are a result of budget pressures in the department?
I think it's a result of, yes, I think they want to maintain the program, but they also look for ways to save money in the program, so certainly.
And Glenn, what have you been seeing in the environment?
Well, certainly on the environmental front, it's always been a struggle to work for good, positive environmental advocacy in Arkansas, no matter who's been in office. I would like to point out, I guess, something that hasn't been so much of a problem lately, but it certainly was a problem recently, when we had so much natural gas fracking going on in the state of Arkansas, and not nearly enough inspectors to go and look at these wells, make sure that they're operating properly, make sure that they're not leaking, so forth. There was a period of time there where we had about 8 inspectors total for the state of Arkansas, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these wells. That's not the kind of situation that the natural state should be in, but it's definitely a result of fiscal policy and budget choices. There are people who don't want a lot of inspectors out there. I do want a lot of inspectors out there making sure that our air and our water is fine. When there's not money to pay them, you're not going to have those inspectors doing their job.
And I feel like I've heard recently, though, that the prices for fracked oil are an upward trend, so we're going to start seeing more fracking again.
I'm certainly hoping that's not the case, but if so, that's all the more reason not to cut state budgets. We're going to need folks to make sure that those people are doing their job in the correct way, because when nobody's looking, a lot of folks don't do it the right way. We all know that.
And Bo, I'm curious, going back to hospitals, it also seems like I've been hearing a lot of rural hospitals and rural healthcare facilities are especially facing budget pressures, and quite a few have closed down. Do you attribute that to budget pressures of the state also?
Well, when we look around the nation at states that did not expand their Medicaid program like we did in Arkansas, and we're very thankful that Arkansas did expand Medicaid and create the Arkansas Works program. But you look at a state like Texas, where they've had 14 rural hospitals close. Mississippi's had 5 or 6. Tennessee's had about the same. Georgia's had 8. So the states that did not expand Medicaid, particularly in the South, they've seen rural hospital closures. We haven't seen that here, thankfully. But certainly, if we're going to initiate more Medicaid reductions in eligibility, it certainly affects the bottom line of hospitals and their viability in the rural community. I can tell you that there's a number of hospitals that are barely making ends meet to keep the doors open, and we can't afford to lose one of them. We've got 26 counties right now that don't have a hospital, so we don't want to see any hospital in Arkansas close.
And again, if you have any questions, we're talking about proposed tax cuts at the state level. You can give us a call at 501-433-0088. And Rich, what about around the issues that Arkansas Advocates works on?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the tax cuts that we've already enacted, have had major financial implications for things like education. If you look at K-12 education, there's an adequacy study. That's basically done every couple of years. And the legislature the last 2 years has funded K-12 education at a rate of about 1%, when that adequacy study actually called for an increase of closer to 2%. And so now 1% versus 2%, doesn't sound like a big difference, but that adds up to tens of millions of dollars in terms of possible funding for the public schools. Pre-K, really significantly underfunded in Arkansas. We're probably about $20 million short than what we would have been if we had kept funding pre-K over the last 8 years, just based on the cost of inflation. Juvenile justice reform, we have major work to do there, but we have a significantly underfunded juvenile justice. We still have not funded after-school and summer programs with state revenue, which the research says is one of the things that we really need to do in Arkansas to improve grade-level reading. So I think there have been lots of, lots of implications. I will say that, quite frankly, if it wasn't for Medicaid expansion, which has really brought in a lot of new money to the state, we would have seen, much more dramatic impacts of these tax cuts, especially... I guess in healthcare, were it not for all the new money because of Medicaid expansion. Is that right, Bo?
That's true. That's true. Medicaid expansion brought in over $1 billion into the state's economy, and certainly you can turn that over into hospitals, healthcare providers out there. It's certainly impacted the economy in a positive way.
Well, think about we have a real life example of what happens when you are irresponsible with tax cuts, right? Everybody's pointing to Kansas. The last few years, right? You had a situation where you had a governor who campaigned on tax cuts. He got in there and he and his legislature really put some serious tax cuts into law, and Kansas is suffering as a result. If Kansas was a company, Kansas would be bankrupt. New governors had to come in and really try to fix a gigantic hole in that state's budget, and people in Kansas are feeling it. I'm no way saying that our governor is Sam Brownback. I think Asa Hutchinson has been somewhat responsible, especially comparatively to our neighbors in Kansas. But this is the kind of thing that, you campaign on short-term political gain, I'm going to cut your taxes, and then there's political reality, and the governmental reality. There's a big difference between campaigning and governing. And when you're governing on tax cuts that are not well thought out, and they've got a political angle to them, people hurt, and we're not in good shape. I like what you said, Rich, about how Medicaid expansion saved us, and that's not wrong at all. If we hadn't had that, we'd be in a much worse situation. People would be talking about Kansas and Arkansas, which would be tough.
It's not just been Kansas. Oklahoma basically had the same thing, Louisiana and North Carolina. And what you saw in all those states was basically the same story. You had big personal income tax cuts, and then you had big budget deficits. So in states like Kansas, Oklahoma, they had to cut back on the number of days a week that kids could go to school, and they had to leave miles and miles of roads desperately needing repairs.
I've recently driven through there and experienced that.
Yes, what we're talking about. So.
Well, I guess that leads me to my last question on this portion of the show. Instead of tax cuts, what are other policies that we could implement that would address these issues and bring economic growth to the state?
Well, I think instead of tax cuts, we need to be doing the opposite thing. We need to be making greater investments in things like healthcare, things like education, in infrastructure, highways and roads, in technology, because those are the things that really drive state economies. And if you really want to recruit high wage workers with the skills, with businesses, that are going to bring good jobs as a state, cutting taxes, is not the answer. I mean, you want to have an environment in Arkansas, I mean, where you really can attract well-qualified workers, companies who are willing to create higher-paying jobs here. I mean, you don't do that just by cutting taxes, because I think if research has shown us anything, it's when states have big tax cuts. Well, what happens? Companies will come in, take advantage of those, and then guess what happens in 4 or 5 years down the line? You know, they leave. We could also be investing in our workers through things like a state earned income tax credit. You know, one of the things that Arkansas Advocates tried to push during all the meetings of the tax task force was, instead of doing high income tax cuts or corporate income tax cuts, you know, let's invest in our workers, through a state earned income tax credit. Because if you look at the federal EITC, that's widely regarded as the most successful anti-poverty program we've had for children and families in this country. And so we wanted to do something similar in Arkansas. And those are tax cuts that are actually spent locally. Where if you do, high income tax cuts, heck, high-income individuals, could spend those tax cuts anywhere in the world. Low-income workers, when they get tax cuts, they're going to spend their tax cuts locally, the local economy.
Well, we've got a lot of opportunities for improvement and investment here in Arkansas. Certainly there's needs in education, higher education, health and human services, corrections, highways. But certainly I would like to see investment in health care. Obviously, We are an unhealthy state, so investing in healthcare means more people are able to get healthy, be covered with insurance, they can work. Also, it means they're moving up the ladder. And then also, by having people covered selfishly, it helps hospitals, because uncompensated care is not there, so hospitals are able to provide jobs in the community. And what better way to reach out to the entire state of Arkansas than through healthcare?
You know, if you're looking to grow Arkansas, one of the things that people look at, in addition to what Bo and Rich have said, is people are looking, if they're looking to move to your state, they're looking for a good quality of life. You know, they want places that are healthy to raise their kids. They want good forest. They want good air quality, all that kind of stuff. I think that we've got to invest in high qualities of life in Arkansas, and that means good jobs, and it means clean air, and it means clean water, and it means all these good things that attract people. And so instead of giving huge tax abatements and tax incentives to polluting industries to come to Arkansas and build their steel mills or their wood pellet factories or their dirty power plants or paper mills or whatever we've been doing all the last few years, where we're throwing gigantic sums of money at companies to come to Arkansas and bring all their pollution with them. Why don't we invest in high tech? Why don't we invest in clean energy? Why don't we invest in things that are going to attract people who want to work in the clean energy industry? Because that's the kind of people that can really bring Arkansas up. And it's a kind of opportunity that we haven't really had in Arkansas in our history, where you can have good, high-paying jobs that don't hurt our air quality and don't hurt our environment. Arkansas is kind of uniquely situated. I think our people are the kind of people who are able to do that kind of work, and they want to do that kind of work. So I'd like to shift our focus a little bit in let's stop bringing dirty, polluting industries into Arkansas and using our tax dollars as an incentive.
Well, thank you both for joining our show today. Rich is going to stay with us, and we're going to move into our conversation about minimum wage in just a moment. But Bo and Glenn, thank you so much for being on the show today. We really appreciate it. And we're going to go
to a
quick commercial break.
Hi, I'm Johnny Erickson Tata. Never did I realize the significance of cancer screenings until I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. Like most women, I was aware of breast cancer and the importance of screenings, but with my quadriplegia, well, I thought I had other health-related issues to worry about, like pressure sores from my wheelchair or preventing urinary tract infections. Unfortunately, I'm not the only one. A recent UK study found that compared to others, women with disabilities were over 30% less likely to be screened for breast cancer. For some women, it's a lack of access to a car that keeps them from making the appointment. For others, it's the cost or timing. But friend, you can find the time, as well as affordable options. For a link to the CDC's list of recommended cancer screenings, visit disabilitycampaign.org, and please make that cancer screening appointment.
You're listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I'm Rebecca Zimmerman, and we are back to talk about Issue 5, the minimum wage amendment that will be on the November ballot. Let's get started. Rich, can you explain what Issue 5 actually is and what it would do for Arkansas, or what it would do on the ballot?
Sure. If the voters pass it in November, it would gradually increase the state minimum wage from, I believe, $8.50 now, Steve, to $11 an hour. I mean, we'd do that gradually through the year 2021, I believe. Is that right?
Okay. And how many Arkansans would this impact? What kind of jobs do most Arkansans have?
Sure. Well, I will say that in 3 weeks, Arkansas Advocates is going to be putting out a report on the economic impact on the minimum wage. So we don't have all of those numbers finalized for release just yet. But I will say that some of the preliminary numbers we've seen, I mean, basically show that over 300,000 low-wage workers are going to be impacted. That's going to include over 200,000 workers who are going to be directly impacted, but it's also another 100,000 workers who already make the minimum wage, but who will likely see their wages go up above the $11 an hour because the minimum wage will put pressure to increase wages for other employees. So it's going to have a huge impact on low-income workers in Arkansas.
And if you have any questions for the show, you can give us a call at 501-433-0088. And 300,000 people, that's quite a large amount of Arkansans. What impact would this have on kids and families in the state? I read some census data, and you probably have more updated data in the report that's going to be released in a few weeks, but that the average Arkansan just makes about $23,000 a year. So it does sound like this will impact a lot of people. What does that actually look like, having more wages for kids and families in the state?
I think what that means is that you will have families who will have a greater ability to meet basic needs. And so things for like paying their rent, buying groceries, buying school supplies, basic things that the typical family needs to get by day to day.
And we're also joined by Reverend Steve Copley with Faith Voices Arkansas. What kind of impact do you think this will have? You do a lot of work with people with low incomes.
Well, it's interesting. Rich made the point earlier when you ask about, well, what kind of jobs do we have in Arkansas? Well, and nationally as well as Arkansas, we've seen over the last 40 years a real shift from manufacturing jobs to service type jobs, particularly in occupations that pay right at the minimum wage. And it's interesting when we just about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when we were looking at the ballot measure in 2006, the study discovered about 120,000, 130,000 people impacted by this increase. Now we're talking 300,000, which goes to show a decade, 12 years later, how much impact that, again, the transition to a service economy, to lower paying jobs, and it's impacting even more people now than 12 years ago. It's really amazing when you think right now at $8.50 an hour, that's $17,680 a year. If we get to $11 an hour, that's $22,880. What kind of impact? Rich mentioned. Think about it. If you do buy $100 a week in groceries, and that is a low ball figure, that's $5,200 right there. If you go and you spend $300 a month on rent, that's $36. We're pushing over $10,000, and all I've done with very low estimates is buy food and put a roof over my house. Never mind How do I buy clothes? How do I buy transportation, afford transportation? So every inch we can make in a gain for minimum wage keeps people from being behind, which is what, you know, we wait so many years between the increase in the minimum wage, and we hear critics say, well, that's, you know, that raises the costs of everything else. But the problem is it puts hardworking Arkansans behind the eight ball, as I say, and this will really help try to get them where they're not just looking and going, how do I make it? You know, I'm behind and I haven't even gotten started.
And Rich, Arkansas Advocates just released a report on the connection between health and wealth for Arkansans. Can you talk about some of those, the findings in that report and the recommendations, and how you think that would tie back into this particular issue on the ballot?
Sure. Well, not surprisingly, the report found a really, you know, strong connection between between growing up in poverty, I mean, also the ability to have a healthy life, and so I think the extent to which families have higher incomes, so that's definitely going to impact their ability, you know, to be healthy, because I think, the research clearly shows, that if you have more income, you're much more likely to be able to obtain health care. You're much more likely to be able to engage in healthy behaviors like buying healthy food, for example. I mean, like a lot of low-income folks, when they go to the grocery store, you know, they don't have the luxury to buy, healthy foods on their income, because, quite frankly, it's all, frozen, prepackaged foods, which are a lot cheaper. It's usually what they can afford. And so the thought of going to Whole Foods for a low-income family, buying the freshest organic, you know, fruits and vegetables, that's just not an option for a lot of low-income folks. Impacts their ability, to be healthy, because nutrition is such a big part of being healthy.
So. And they can afford better housing with more income, and we certainly know what substandard housing does and impact it has on people's health. So there those kind of direct correlations are there.
And this will have a big impact on children as well, right? I mean, if a child's living in a low-income family, that affects every aspect of their life.
That's true. And to give you one number that's going to be coming out of our study in a few weeks, 107,000 children will be directly impacted, you know, because those numbers that I gave you earlier were just on the number, we're just on the number of workers, not the total number of people who are going to be impacted. That was the number of workers who are going to be impacted. But most of these workers have, they have families and they have kids. So we know, that increasing in the minimum wage, is directly going to impact about 110,000 kids, which is huge.
I've also heard too, though, that, a child going into school when they are dealing with issues that are happening at home because of their low income, it can affect their ability to do well in school.
Yeah. I think if you look at the factors associated with kids entering kindergarten, for example, in terms of who's ready to succeed right away in kindergarten, there's a big relationship to income. Because I think, middle, and upper income families, are much more able, to buy things like books, for example, for their kids. They're much more likely to have extra time to be able to read to their kids. They're much more likely to be able, to provide the goods and services that are really going to allow their kids to be, emotionally, socially, cognitively, prepared to succeed in school. And so, if you want to do one thing to really help put your kid in a position, to succeed in school, quite frankly, having a lot more income, is one thing you could do, quite frankly. Just because that's going to make it much more likely that you're going to be able to provide for your child, provide the things that we know will help them succeed.
And if you have any questions, we're talking about issue 5 that will be on the ballot in November about increasing the minimum wage. You can give us a call at 501-433-0088. And Steve, you've worked on this issue in the past. Why did Faith Voices decide to work on minimum wage amendments and trying to increase minimum wage?
Well, for myself and others who are from the faith community, this really is a faith issue. We, across all faith traditions, one of the major tenets is a belief in life and a quality of life. And, I mean, we would argue for a living wage, but we keep moving toward that. And when folks, you know, have enough money, when they're working hard and they're playing by the rules and they can actually afford to live in a home that that's safe and can buy new food that's nutritious and can provide for their families, that means their family, their children all get ahead. So it really is an issue about life and the quality of life. So that's why we've always been involved and why we're involved again. It's just time, you know. Years have gone by, and we need to continue to get the wage up where so many people can have a little better quality of life.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say, you know, I mean, there are some folks out there who raise the issue of, well, you know, the economy is doing well right now. You know, we have low unemployment. You know, why do we need to increase the minimum wage? Well, I mean, I think it's important to note that quite frankly, for low income workers, I mean, inflation has really eaten away at any gains that they might have had through a tighter labor market. And so, in so many ways, workers are actually behind where they are from just a couple of years ago. Now, who's benefiting in the economy? Quite frankly, it's people who own stock, who own housing. Those are the people who are making money off the economy right now, whereas, you know, other low income workers, true, we may have low unemployment, but what you have to recognize is that many of those folks are working two jobs, in some cases three jobs, just to support their families. Think about the implications of having to work, you know, two or three different jobs just to support your family, both in terms of the amount of time that you have to spend with your family, but also what it means in terms of family stability. And we really need to increase the minimum wage to a higher level, if for no other reason, just to make it less likely that low-income workers are going to have to work two or three jobs just to meet the minimum essentials.
And again, and from the faith community, absolutely, that the stability of the family, if somebody's working two, three jobs, they're not home, they're not interacting with family members, with their children, and so it has a huge impact. And yes, unemployment's gone down, but all the figures from the Labor Department is wages have stuck. And Rich is right. Many people are actually worse off now, even though unemployment is almost at least, you know, at a very minimal level, but they're just the value of what they get paid hasn't caught up.
And going back to the first half of our show, if these proposed tax cuts go forward, a lot of programs that low-income workers do rely on to fill in those gaps that they're not able to pay for because they're low wages, those are going to be cut back too, and they might lose access.
Yeah, let's not forget, that in Arkansas we still have a child poverty rate that is still almost 1 in 4 kids. Think about that. One out of every four kids in our state are living in a family, who have an income below the poverty line. And so, if for no other reason, we need to increase the minimum wage, for those kids there, just for that population.
And that makes me think, can you also talk about generational poverty and the impact that could have and how that would relate to wage?
Sure. Generational poverty is when you have, is when you have poverty, that really lasts across generations of family. So you may have your grandmother's family, and then your mother's family, and then your family who have all lived in poverty. There are a lot of factors associated with that. Oftentimes, of course, it does have the fact that if one family is living in poverty, it makes it much less likely that they're going to be able to do the things, provide the things that will allow their kids to succeed in the long run. So, I mean, so things like, buying books. Living in the neighborhoods that have the best schools. Things like that. And so, poverty does last across generations. But if you really want to put kids in a position to succeed, that means that they have to be in a position to succeed in school. To get the skills that are really, that will really allow them to compete for the better paying jobs. If you're not doing that, then you're making it much more likely that generation after generation of family is going to continue to live in poverty.
And so the minimum wage issue on the ballot, if that passes, that will impact some people greater than others, correct? There are differences in wages based on gender and race, correct?
Yeah, without citing a specific study, numerous studies have shown that if you're female and if you're African American or Hispanic, you're paid your wages much lower than somebody who's a white male. And those figures have been that way for years and years and years in this country, and it's been study after study after study that, again, that pushes toward generational poverty, and we live in we're in a rural state that's increasingly seeing population bases in Central Arkansas and Northwest Arkansas. But in rural areas, one reason we have so much poverty, the jobs are service-based. They're mom and pops, where they really can't employ a lot of people, if anybody. Yet people are still there. As I say, they're the folks that get left behind. They can't leave or don't leave for whatever reason to come to Little Rock or to the Northwest Quadrant. And many times they are women, and they're African-American or Hispanic.
And we've talked a lot about how low wages impact individuals and families and kids. How do low wages impact the economy as a whole, if at all?
I think it's back to what I said earlier. We've transitioned our economy from a much more manufacturing. Well, there were two. There was an agricultural base, and in 40, 50 years ago, having lived in Southeast Arkansas and watched rice farmers. Well, at one point they needed to hire many folks in order to deal with rice production. Now two people can do it, or three, and we've moved from larger manufacturing areas to very much a service economy, where folks are thrust into working at grocery stores, at smaller wages, at fast foods establishments. So it, in some ways it has a way of, and that's why I think we're seeing some of our wages right now, even though unemployment's down, we're seeing them stuck. The economy, the type of economy we've structured, pushes wages down, or at least causes them to remain constant rather than going up in times of low unemployment. And I'm not an economist, so somebody might want to challenge that, but it just seems to me that's what I see low wages doing to our economy in general.
Yeah. And I will say this about increasing the minimum wage, though, is that, it's really been shown not to only to have a positive economic impact among those families who are impacted by higher wages, either directly or indirectly. But you have to remember that those families, where are they going to spend the extra money? They're going to spend it locally, the local economy. And so, so not only does it help them, but it helps the local economy as well. And nearly every study on the minimum wage, after the minimum wage increases, businesses don't lay off workers. That usually does not happen. Why don't they lay off workers when their wage costs go up because of a higher minimum wage? Well, one, you're less likely to have turnover. That means that companies don't have to spend a lot of time and energy trying to hire new workers and train them. If you're doing that, then it makes for a more experienced I'm in skilled workforce for a company. I mean, so companies benefit in other ways from increasing the minimum wage. It's not it's not just the workers, but companies themselves benefit. I mean, that's been true of most of the good studies that have been done on the minimum wage. It's not led to companies laying off workers. In many ways, it's really helped, the bottom line of companies, because they've been able to keep workers, not have to have turnover, not have to have to spend as much on training costs. So
I agree with Rich. Every time we hear, this is going to cut jobs, and every study, over decades, whenever the minimum wage is increased, business productivity goes up, workers are happier, health, their emotional state's better, their health's better, the business actually benefits. And every time, we hear the same mantra again. Well, we're going to have to cut jobs. And this is just not the case. They benefit greatly from, not only do the workers benefit, so do the companies.
Yeah. This is really, especially true, for industries like service industries, retail industries, that really depend on their workers for that face-to-face interaction with customers. A lot of studies have shown that customer service actually goes up when you pay your employees more. Well, who would have thought of that? That customer service would go up because you're paying your employees better. Well, employees are much more likely to care about their job, and they're much more likely to have a better attitude, when they're being paid what they think they need to be paid.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas. We're talking about the minimum wage ballot initiative that will be on the people will be voting on in November. If you have any questions or have a comment, you can give us a call at 501-433-0088. In the last 10 minutes or so that we have, I'd like to talk about some other policies that would benefit low-income workers, not just the minimum wage ballot initiative. But Steve, you brought up safer housing.
Yeah, safer and affordable is the key if you go around Arkansas. And Arkansas passed the enabling legislation for a housing trust fund in 2009. And what the housing trust fund was to work with a number of folks, from for-profit developers, nonprofit developers, to provide affordable housing for folks who not just low income, but that might be priced out of the housing market. So just every correlation's there between quality housing and affordable housing and people's health and their well-being, and especially when we look at rural Arkansas, where the housing stock is getting much older, and folks are thrust into having to either buy or rent housing that's can oftentimes be very substandard and put health at risk. So we need to capitalize the housing trust funds, where I'm headed. We passed the enabling legislation 5 years ago or so. We were able to get what was a relatively small amount of money to do some pilot projects, but that needs to be capitalized. But the return on that investment's absolutely amazing. And so that would be certainly one way to help folks who are some other ways to help average working Arkansans.
Steve, do you want to talk a little bit about the landlord-tenant rights situation? Do you know much about that?
A little bit. We're the only state where there's not a requirement of habitability. And so if you rent from someone, you basically the landlord does not have to keep the property in any kind of living condition, is not obligated under law. And again, if you're a hardworking Arkansan and you're renting and you can't afford to buy a house, you're renting, sometimes you're thrust into really substandard housing and you have no protections under the law. And many times it becomes a catch-22, because if you're in the middle of a lease and they don't want to repair this huge leak in a roof and mold's developing, and we know what happens in some of those cases, folks get ill. Then they say, well, we just won't pay our rent. And then they're evicted, and we're into this huge cycle, because once you're evicted, that has an impact on your family, even your working possibilities. So We're the only state in the United States that doesn't have any, warranty of habitability that's required of a landlord. So, again, another piece of legislation that, you know, it's not directly wages but could have a huge impact on folks who are hardworking and playing by the rules.
Well, I mean, I believe Arkansas is still the only state where, I mean, it doesn't happen very often, but at least legally, if tenants don't pay their rent, landlords have a legal right to actually try and get them criminally prosecuted.
That's correct.
Now,
yes.
Again, it doesn't happen, but just having that threat that they can hold over a low-income family, I mean, forces them to make decisions that, quite frankly, just aren't decisions, I mean, that they would otherwise make. I mean, because who wants to have a mom or dad face that threat, even if it might not happen?
And if it does happen, then you have a criminal record, and what's that do for a job? You probably lose your job. The possibilities of that's the threat that they're looking at. So yes, we're the only state where they have the criminal recourse to eviction, as opposed to a civil recourse, and that's got a huge impact.
So that's something that needs to be changed as well. In addition to really coming up with some real adequate funding for the
housing trust fund.
Mm-hmm. And Rich, on the first half of our show, you also talked about the earned income tax credit. Could you explain a bit more about what that is and how that works and how people can access it currently?
Sure. Well, of course, right now, Arkansas is not one of the roughly 30 states that has a state earned income tax credit. I mean, there is the federal level. I mean, the federal earned income tax credit, which research has widely shown. I mean, that's really kind of one of the most successful anti-poverty programs we have in this country. It lifts 6 million people directly out of poverty each year. And so many states have tried to build upon the success of the federal EITC, which again, you have to be working. I mean, it really is designed kind of for low income workers, but you have to have earned income. You have to be working to qualify for it. But basically, it would be a supplement to your wages. The way that state EITCs work is that they're usually calculated as some percentage of whatever federal EITC you might get through your tax return. If you're getting, let's say that you're getting $2,000 back in terms of a federal earned income tax credit. Your state had, say, a state EITC that was equal to 10% of the federal credit. Well, then you would get, $200 back if you were qualifying for a $2,000 federal EITC. So it does kind of vary state by state. But the one really nice thing about the earned income tax credit is that it's refundable, which is basically just a technical way of saying that if your credit is worth more than what you actually have to pay in taxes, you actually get that difference back in the form of a refund. That's not true of all tax credits. So that's a tax credit. That really is designed to help low-income workers. They can use that refund on things like groceries, a car payment, buying clothes for their kids. Whatever a low-income family needs. Now it is more generous for families with kids. But again, Arkansas needs to do that. We've not done that yet. We've pushed for it over the past year, with this tax task force. In the end, they voted not to include that among their recommendations. But Arkansas Advocates is going to keep pushing for that in 2019 and 2021 until we get it done.
And really quick, we have a minute and a half left. Bo, also on the first half of our show, mentioned the new work requirements for Medicaid expansion. How is that going to impact people who are working in the state?
Well, basically you get three strikes and you're out under that new system, which is quite frankly just a total disaster because it's an online-based system, which, of course, if you know anything about Arkansas, we rank among the worst states in terms of internet access. I mean, yet we're doing that. I mean, so basically what's going to happen is that we're going to have tens of thousands of low-income adults, I mean, who are going to lose their health insurance. And I mean, that's not bad not only for their health, but it's also going to impact their families, because many of these low-income adults, I mean, have kids. I mean, so that's going to hurt their ability, I mean, to provide for their families, because if they have to pay, you know, greater health care cost out of their own pocket, I mean, to compensate for that, then what's that going to mean? That's going to mean less money for things like books, clothes for their kids, I mean, whatever their families need.
Well, thank you both for being with us today. We really appreciate it, and we will be back next month. You're listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Alanis Morissette, and you're listening to KABF 88.3 in Little Rock, the voice of the people.
Today on Wings, Mayan Weaving Revival in Guatemala, following an era of genocidal repression against the indigenous people.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In a small town in Guatemala, indigenous Mayan women are reviving an ancient skill. Anna Catherine Brigida reports for Wings.
It's an overcast Tuesday afternoon in Santiago Zacatepeques, a small town about an hour from Guatemala City and a half hour from colonial tourist town Antigua. Of the roughly 30,000 residents, about 80% are indigenous Mayans from the Cachiquel community. Weaving has been part of their culture for centuries, but lately, fewer and fewer women know how to weave the traditional Mayan textiles.